Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. On today's show, I speak with documentary filmmaker Graham Colbeans and producer Anne Ishii. Together, they collaborated on the new documentary film, Queer Japan, which, as the title may suggest, focuses on LGBTQ and queer culture in Japan. That's coming up on Endeavors.
You're listening to Endeavors Radio with your host from Toronto, Ontario, Canada, Dan McPeak.
Well, hi there. Happy Monday, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. On today's show, I'll be talking a lot about queer art and culture and activism, specifically in Japan. There is a new documentary out called Queer Japan, directed by the Canadian Graham Colbeans and produced by the American Anne Ishii. Graham is a documentary filmmaker who's done a lot of work in queer art and activism, including the web series Rad Queers and the short film The House of Gay Art. He is the co-founder and creative director of the brand Massive Goods, which is a fashion brand and manga publisher that predominantly works with LGBTQ and feminist comic artists in Japan, and particularly gay manga. With his collaborator, Anne Ishii, they are the co-editor of two books on Japanese gay art, The Passion of Gengoro Tagame, about the gay manga artist Gengoro Tagame, and the Fantagraphics anthology, Massive, Gay Erotic Manga and the Men Who Make It, which was nominated for an Eisner Award in 2015. The two of them also collaborated on the Koyama Press English language edition of What is Obscenity, a graphic memoir by the artist Rokuden Ashiko, chronicling her arrest and obscenity charges for making 3D printed clitoral art. And that book was nominated for a Los Angeles Times Book Award. Graham has also worked with the Japan-U.S. Friendship Commission, and he was named a recipient of that, of their Creative Artists Exchange Fellowship in 2016, which is how Queer Japan came to be, and he spent 5 months in Japan filming that documentary. Some of the subjects featured in the film include the aforementioned Gengoro Tame, drag queen and artist Vivian Sato, transgender politician Aya Kamikawa, and photographer Leslie Key. Other people in the film include artist Akira the Hustler, Tetsuro Onigasuka, who's a professor at Kyoto Sanko University, Margaret, which is an organizer of Department H, Masaki Matsumoto, a queer SL YouTuber, Hiroshi Hakagawa, HIV activist and co-founder of G-Men, transgender rights activist Tomato Hatakeno, and multimedia artist Nogi Sumiko. His collaborator on the film is Anne Ishii, who herself is a writer, editor, translator, and producer based in New York City. In addition to the aforementioned The Passion of Gengoro Tagame, she is the translator of the English version of Tagame's manga, My Brother's Husband. Other translation credits include the Aranzi Machine Gun series, the cute book, The Bad Book, Gunji, and Bat Manga, The Secret History of Batman in Japan. Formerly with Vertical, she is currently the editor-in-chief of They're All So Beautiful and Paper Houses. Her writing has been published in The Village Voigt, Slate, Publishers Weekly, Guernica, Giant Robot, and Asian American Writers Workshop. This is my conversation with director Graham Colbeans and producer En Ishii on the film Queer Japan.
Cool.
Well,
ooh.
Graham, Anne, hello. Thank you for being here on this Sunday.
Thanks for having us, Dan.
Yes.
Thank you.
You are partners in a great film called Queer Japan. I had a chance to see the documentary. And Graham, I know for you, this project began when you were... was it the some Japanese American organization?
So I think you're talking about Giant Robot, which is the company that Anne and I met through doing. I was working at their Comic-Con booth and doing some other work with them in the late 2000s when I got to know Anne.
That's right. Yeah. It's funny to think of Giant Robot as a Japanese-American organization, though.
Yeah, it's very much like, it was this really important magazine for a long time, depicting all kinds of Asian and Asian-American culture. Eric Nakamura, the founder of Giant Robot, still runs a few stores where they sell artwork and toys and stuff, but unfortunately the magazine's no longer available.
But is it true, Graham, that this specific documentary came about because you were a recipient in a
fellowship? Oh, the friendship.
The Japan-US Friendship Council?
Okay, yeah, sorry, I was getting my wires crossed. yeah, the film... was made possible through a grant from the Japan U.S. Friendship Commission. And they do an annual grant to 5 artists in this program called the Creative Artists Exchange Fellowship. And so Queer Japan was selected as one of the projects for 2016. And that allowed us to go and shoot for 5 months in Japan, which wouldn't have been possible on just like a regular tourist visa, because the JUSFC provides these longer term cultural visas.
You mentioned Comic-Con, and I know that the two of you edited something called the Passion of Gengoro Tagame, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, as well as massive gay erotic manga and the fan or and the men who make it. How does one get in, or for at least for you two, how do you get into manga in the first place? Where did that interest stem from?
I'll take a first stab at this. I feel like I think it's funny because that's actually the right question, but it's also sort of in the Comic-Con world. If you ask somebody like, "How'd you get into comics?" it's kind of a hard question to answer, right? Like, I don't know, they were just sort of around, or, you know, especially manga, if you grew up in the culture, that's something I know as a Japanese person, like you get exposed to it at a really early age. So it's just sort of something that's around. But with gay manga, and I think for me specifically, I was never like a manga head or a comics nerd per se until really right at the end of college. And my interest in gay manga actually came from gay men who were consuming it for its primary purpose, which is to titillate them. And I was usually called upon to sort of help find more or to like help translate the stories. So that was my introduction to it. Graham?
For me, I feel like it was, like Anne said, it was just kind of around, like, especially before I even started reading manga, I was watching anime, starting with Sailor Moon, and continuing on with classic series like Neon Genesis Evangelion. And like, I remember watching Akira at age 10 or 11 and being obsessed with it. And then it wasn't until junior high school that I started reading manga. I remember distinctly like being in band class, and one of my classmates had an an issue of Ranma One Half, which is this amazing gender fluid manga with the main character who switches from male to female. And I was just like, wow, this is amazing. I want to read more manga. So that was initial introduction to it, and I got into some more mainstream stuff. And then when I was a later teenager, I started seeing the manga of artists like Gengoro Tagame and Jiraiya and the other artists contributing to G-Men magazine, which is this legendary gay publication in Japan that ran from 95 to just a couple of years ago. So that was when like my interest in gay manga really exploded, when I started seeing that kind of artwork online. And I remember when we were at Comic-Con with Giant Robot, I was like in the San Diego Convention Center trying to find any booths that might have had those kinds of works. Like I went around to a few other tables, like Prism Comics that distributes gay comics in North America, and asked them, and no one really like knew where I might be able to find issues of G-Men or that kind of stuff. And that's what really inspired Anne and I to start doing these interviews with the artists and putting them together as a collection.
You know, one person that you interview in the film that I think is a type of person that's characterized often in gay manga is the hentai and senpai. Could you elaborate on what those terms mean and how you think them being portrayed in an art form like manga maybe helps bridge the gap between societal, like queer society and queer literature?
Yeah, so the word hentai is often sort of misinterpreted or narrowly interpreted, especially outside of Japan, as a type of erotica, a type of like strange artwork, like porn. But it actually has a much more expansive definition as a word that a couple of people touch on in Queer Japan, including Atsushi Matsuda, who is a buto dancer. And he's someone who sort of like identifies with that term hentai, or at least finds some use in it as an umbrella term of sort of non-normative sexuality.
Yeah, I think just like, I understand why it makes sense to kind of create these neologisms out of the Japanese terms, because the culture is so distinct from the way we understand their counterparts in English. But if, you know, hentai etymologically is tied to also transformation, or just like it's perversion, but in the sense of like resistance. And then a word like senpai too is, you know, senpai kohai is just like junior, senior. But because those dynamics in Japanese culture are so different, I mean, I get that they need to be sort of maintained in their sort of Japanese format, but there are corollaries. It's just, it's funny because this is the work I feel like I'm always mired in as a translator, is like when does it feel appropriate to translate it, and when is it important to like give, you know, keep it narrowly defined, as Grimm says.
You talk about culture, and I think at least here in the West, there's this idea of Japan as a very sort of strict and rigid work and societal culture. It's, you know, it's very regimented. How does the queer subculture that we see in the film, how does that fit in or not fit in with sort of the traditional norms that we see in Japan?
Yeah, so a couple of people that we talked to made an analogy to don't ask, don't tell in the United States, this term meaning that there's a certain amount of like permission, but also please don't bring this subject up in certain environments in Japanese society, which can be like the workplace, in family environments, it's harder to talk about these kinds of things. But at the same time, there are a few LGBT celebrities in the national spotlight. Matsuko Deluxe, who is this, who's in a lot of advertising and daily talk shows. So it's not something that is like completely unheard of, but it's also not actively promoted in the mainstream culture.
Yeah, I also would say like, I think the stereotype of the Japanese culture is being traditional, but you correctly pointed out that it's a social culture and a work culture. It's not a values-based culture. So Japanese culture can be very regimented, but it isn't by any means more conservative than the US, right? Which is so conservative. So I think the things that happen in the bedroom are all sort of allowed and just assumed, and you know, but in that sense it's a very free culture. But in the external sort of presentation of like the workday being extraordinarily long, or how everybody's really quiet about their private lives, that those are aspects that I think, you know, I think, as you know, like you said, Westerners might just find sort of confusing, right? Like a person who usually lives out loud 100% of the time, but maybe in Japan it just, you know, does get compartmentalized a different way.
One of the things that I do notice, especially with some of the queens that you talk to, is their extraordinary sense of fashion. And I feel like, you know, fashion plays a big part of a lot of LGBTQ cultures, but specifically in Japan. And it strikes me that Tokyo is one of the fashion capitals of Asia. How do you think the fashion scene at large in Tokyo is perhaps bridging a gap to more acceptance of the queer subcultures that we see?
Yeah, the thing that comes to mind immediately when you say fashion in terms of queer Japan is this amazing monthly underground hentai party called Department H that we had the privilege of filming. And the sort of the drag queen mama of Department H is Margaret, and she's the host and the MC, and she always has an amazing ensemble on. And then the party itself has a lot of different aspects, a lot of different things going on, but in the center of it, there's a runway, and people walk the runway with their own sort of like kink looks, their fantastical rubber and latex looks. A lot of it's homemade, a lot of it is custom. And so that was like an amazing sort of subterranean fashion scene to get to examine up close. I don't know that it necessarily like has a direct impact on high fashion in Japan, but I think those are, you can see a lot of creativity and uniqueness in that scene and throughout queer culture.
Yeah, I would add that those dovetailing off of that social culture you referred to, which feels very strict from the outside, that I think that bridge that the fashion provides is also just not limited to the queer community, but how Japanese fashion and culture, like in the US and in Canada, is very homogeneous now, right? Like everybody goes to Uniqlo and Muji and gets the same like drab clothing. So just to be able to resist that, I think we could have a whole other conversation about how fashion is resisting this like homogenization of, you know, clothing culture generally. But it's nice because I think people are sort of empowered to make their insides match their outsides, you know.
Well, I wanted to pick up on that because I think, again, in the West, there's this perception that Japan is a very homogeneous country in terms of its people and its sort of lifestyle. How much have you seen that changing over the course of when you shot this documentary?
You know, I just want to jump in real quick on that because I think what a movie like Queer Japan does, I hope, is to show that Japan isn't so homogenous, right? Like, but I think the thing I would keep emphasizing is that this is all an interpretation that it is homogenous. And yeah, there are aspects of the culture that appear homogenous because, you know, like, salaryman clothing culture, but then I would challenge you to find any sort of subculture of the US that doesn't look really homogenous too, right? Like if you go to Wall Street, everybody's wearing the same light blue button down with khakis. So, you know, I think in that sense, these cultures have always been there. It's just how we've paid attention to it that's changed. On the other hand, I mean, to address the very real part of the culture, which is like, you know, the sort of the virtues that I think a lot of older generations of Japanese people adhere to are like, don't stand out, or like the tallest reed gets cut first. Like those are the kinds of, you know, cliches that get repeated, and I think that's actually something that's important to be thinking about too, if like. But, you know, that there's this sort of negative value placed on sort of showing up or standing out. And that's what's changing, right? That maybe we're taking some of that negativity away from standing up or being a little bit more visible.
And I also think it's worth pointing out that American culture is so deeply obsessed with individualism in a way that's been like exported around the world. I mean, you talk about the West, and yes, like Western culture does share a lot of similar values. And a lot of that comes out of this like fetishization of the individual in America. And the idea that like if you just express yourself through your lifestyle choices to the fullest, then you can like self-actualize and really fulfill that promise of finding the pursuit of happiness. But you know, I think it is to a degree an illusion. It is something that papers over inequities in society. And that, yeah, that same emphasis on individualism isn't as prominent in the like values of Japanese culture at large, I would say, but perhaps it has been becoming more acceptable over the past few decades. And seeing a place like Harajuku, which is one of the fashion capitals of Tokyo, and has famously been exported around the world through publications like Fruits. It is a sort of like beautiful testament to individualism when you walk through there. And it isn't necessarily like a queer neighborhood, but I think there is a lot of overlap, and queer people find a way to express themselves through fashion that comes out of places like Harajuku.
When I was watching the documentary, it struck me that in a way, the sort of the queer culture in Japan is a lot like Berlin. You know, it's very fashion based, but a lot of it is still, I think, underground in a lot of ways. If you know, you really want to find the parties. Why do you think? I mean, and obviously there's Shinjuku. I think it's called the sort of the one neighborhood in Tokyo there. But why do you
Shinjuku.
think?
Okay.
Yeah.
Shinjuku is like a huge, it's
Okay.
almost like a city within Tokyo, and then Nishome is like a neighborhood that has mostly queer bars.
But why do you think it is, you know, for I guess a lot of these different cultures that they still sort of they have to almost drive themselves out of the mainstream to succeed? And do you find that the queer subculture in Japan is slowly starting to become more accepted within the mainstream over there.
I
One.
would,
Go ahead.
sorry, I was just going to say that I think like a lot of people who take pride in their sort of uniqueness or, you know, like Vivian talks about being the noise, but I'm not sure if anybody who relishes in that subculture wants to see it in the mainstream, right? Like, I think everybody would prefer that it remain, quote, underground. I think I'm trying to think. Yeah, Graham, sorry, that was just a thought I had.
No, I think that's spot on. I think there are like a handful of people who cross over into mainstream culture, and there might be like differing attitudes about that. A little bit of pride, a little bit of like, well, they've gone over to that team now, and they're no longer with us. But there is like such a rich culture already happening in the hundreds of bars that are in that one neighborhood, Shinjuku Nichome, and in similar neighborhoods like it throughout cities across Japan and smaller towns even, that it's kind of like, it's, yeah, there's not really so much of a need for this culture to be represented on TV. But I do think that like in the national media, there has started to be more attention to LGBT culture, especially over the last decade. One of our interview subjects, Nogi Sumiko, she was telling us about how in the early 2000s, when Tokyo had its first iteration of the Pride Parade, there was a journalist on like national TV who went to cover the parade and was just, and his comments were like, look at these freaks, look how weird they are, you know, that level of discourse. And now there is more actual substantive and less homophobic conversation around events like that. And I even saw on TV when I was shooting, there was a news program that went down to Shinjuku Nichome. They visited a couple of the well-known bars, and it was kind of like, let's take a look at this culture, but you know, from an outsider perspective, but still like a lot more interest in the cultures of LGBT people starting to show on the mainstream level. So that's encouraging.
There was an interesting shift that happened, I noticed, gradually in the film when it goes from merely profiles of your interview subjects to the more greater, I guess, political aspects of queer society in Japan. What kind of conversations did the two of you have about, I guess, the tone of the film and making that shift from not making it just about the people, but to about the bigger culture as a whole?
Yeah, I think one of the tonal like distinctions we wanted this film to make was that it was something joyful and celebratory, that wasn't stigmatizing or unnecessarily problematizing the lives of the people that it was depicting, but rather we decided to have as natural conversations as you can have in an interview format, but to allow people to bring up the issues that matter to them and then to follow those threads, rather than taking like an objective political look at everything on the political landscape.
Yeah, and I think I just want to commend Graham on doing such a great job of introducing that tone of sort of you know, victory and joy that isn't depending on some sensationalized tragedy. And like, I commend it because I know my instinct was like, where's the conflict? Like, what's the story we can exploit? And how do we make this Tiger King? And, you know, but that's just like my American sensibility. Whereas what's so much, much more important, I think, for queer viewers and the community is to know that the victories can actually be really quiet. Or just like policy is huge, right? Like change in policy would be a huge victory. Just not like sensational. Being recognized by your city and your state as a complete human. I mean, that's a really big deal, but it's really hard to convey that. So I am glad you noticed the shift in tone. And I really think that's a testament to Graham's ability to sort of honor the community.
You know, just while we're on this political aspect, you do include archival footage of a television interview with the councilwoman, I think she's councilwoman Miyu Sugita, who has said a lot of problematic things, not only about the queer community, but about the married people having to have the same last name and educational policies. Why was it important for you to include that type of dialogue and that type of character within this film?
I think it was important to illuminate what the most sort of like outwardly spoken aspects of homophobia look like in Japanese politics. And although Mio Sugita is kind of a fringe figure in politics, she is also part of the party that has been ruling Japanese politics for most of the last 2 decades and beyond. But the LDP, the Liberal Democratic Party, has maintained a very firmly conservative stance against expanding LGBT rights. Shinzo Abe, who recently stepped down after many years of running the country, just basically would only comment that the Japanese Constitution does not allow for same-sex marriage without expressing any personal opinions on the matter. But you see this far right person in his party saying what a lot of people are not going to say, which is that these homosexual people are unproductive, and talking about it in sort of a eugenicsy way, in terms of like we shouldn't support these people because they're not contributing to the next generation, or whatever her weird, twisted motivation for those comments are. And we also just want to add that we tried to balance out that sort of a harsh perspective with a really encouraging story in Japanese politics, which is Setagaya Councilwoman Aya Kamikawa, who's the first openly transgender elected official in Japan. And she's been in politics for 2 decades now, really making important changes to policy, pushing for trans rights and LGBT rights. So, we wanted to show both ends of the spectrum.
I'll just a quick add too that I think at the level of policy making, for conservative politicians, I think the message that makes the most sense to a lot of Japanese people won't be one that comes from like a Judeo-Christian, like sodomy is bad type of messaging, but more like who do you want to be a citizen, right? Like, so it's a lot about who gets to own the privilege of being Japanese. And I find that really problematic too. So, it's interesting just thinking about how that gets manipulated in terms of the like family register that you alluded to. That's like definitely like a that comes from systemic racism, right?
Do you see any parallels at all with the law surrounding the family register and the reluctance of the LGBT or the reluctance of the LDP to recognize LGBT couples since they might be less likely to change their last name when they get married?
So the Kōseki, just for listeners who aren't familiar with this structure, it's this it's basically a family registry that has been in an important part of Japanese bureaucracy for over a century. That it basically it denotes the family lineage of everyone who is a Japanese citizen. And it has all these strangely rigid structures. It's very difficult to, for instance, if even a heterosexual couple getting married, one of them is forced to choose the other's last name based on the way that the Kōseki is set up. And so that has been a fight for some people trying to change that. And of course, the LGBT community wants same-sex marriages or same-sex couples to be able to have the same rights as other people who have their marriages documented in the Kōseki. So it's a complicated system that conservative politicians are reluctant to change, but it's standing in the way of a lot of progress in society, unfortunately.
One thing that we do see at the end is you film some pride festivals in Japan. I think one is in Okinawa there, and we see, you know, we see some people celebrating pride. We see some who aren't. We see some who are ambivalent. And the ambivalent part strikes me as interesting because it almost feels like, in a way, being apolitical about, you know, pride or certain things has become, in a way, the last and most political act one can do. What do you feel about people who are sort of are on the more ambivalent side of things?
Well, yeah, we tried to provide a variety of perspectives, especially in the Tokyo Rainbow Pride segment. We interviewed the organizers as well as activists who were protesting the organizers, and people who are just enjoying themselves and expressing themselves on that day. So there is a variety of approaches to pride, not only in Japan, but around the world. I think we're seeing similar sort of in-group struggles in terms of, like, how do we celebrate pride and make it an event that includes everybody without making it all about corporate sponsorships with problematic companies. And so we tried to include that whole conversation in the pride, in the depiction of pride.
Yeah, I think the point you're making is interesting, though, to suggest that the sort of ambivalence alludes to kind of opting out of the politics of queer identity. And I think to point that might be true, but it's also like pride as a framework is so weird. Like Graham said, it is so complex. Like, I would never want to prevent somebody from enjoying pride or like just, you know, what's the word? Like even if it is a self-interested self-promotion or, you know, like a commercial endorsement, up to a point, I see the purpose of it, right? Like, we still need money. People still need visibility. But as for the politics of it, I think what's so interesting about it is that, like, I think maybe what you're suggesting and what I agree with is a lot of people just want to exist, right? Like, and for it not to be like a story, like I might just be gay and also be an incredibly boring person, right? Like, that's allowed too. So I think that's maybe the more interesting story as we get to like understanding that the culture might be just like as diverse as a whatever other culture where you don't know 85% of the people because they just aren't that interesting.
I know, you know, here in North in Canada, and I'm sure in the U.S., Pride has received a lot of criticism for the last decade becoming very, very corporate. You know, you see organizations like banks or, you know, multinationals coming out and having a float. And to me, it always struck me as, were they actually genuine or are they just trying to, is it just a good PR move for them? In your own observations or with some of the activists that you talked with, what sense do you get of the corporatization of the modern pride movement?
Yeah, it's a tricky one because I've talked to people who have said how important it is to them that like Google is here, but at the same time, Google has prevented their employees from speaking out at the prides they've participated in. Last year, they had a policy that employees could not bring their own signs or t-shirts, had to wear the company uniform and just be there to like promote Google. But Pride started as a protest, and silencing LGBT people in your company is kind of going against the very spirit of that. So it's tricky. I think it's nice to see support from companies, but if they're not putting their money where their mouth is, if they are allowing homophobic people on YouTube and censoring LGBT voices, then, you know, for instance, you have to take account of that and say, do you really want this person, this organization, corporation sponsoring an event that's supposed to celebrate community that they may be actually contributing to the oppression of?
Yeah, and I would guess that just in my understanding of where the activists are in this, in the cast, and just generally, I'm sure it's not lost on anybody every time there's an interaction with a corporate stakeholder that it's problematic, right? I think that, I mean, one thing I might generalize Japanese people as being incredibly good at is understanding consumerism. So, you know, that's something they totally know. The idea of selling out is totally, I mean, that is a big deal. But I don't know where that negotiation starts and stops when it comes to like consistent values. But I mean, of course, Graham's absolutely right that the companies do need to put their money where their mouth is.
So Masaki Matsumoto, who we interviewed at Tokyo Rainbow Pride, they were saying that, you know, of course, an event like this costs a lot of money to put on. So I don't say no sponsors. You just have to be accountable. So I think that's a reasonable request.
At least here in Canada, you know, in Vancouver and Toronto, I think Pride has been criticized a lot for being very still overwhelmingly cis, white, gay male. And it goes back to what we talked about earlier with sort of the homogenous society in Japan. But is that part of the problem with then using the term LGBT versus queer? Because in a way, it feels like certain aspects of Pride are marginalizing themselves and acting as gatekeepers in a way.
That kind of felt like two questions. I'm going to address the first one. It brings to mind something that Nogi Sumiko said in an interview. She's an artist. She is a butch lesbian, kind of is okay with ambiguity in her gender. And she went to Pride back at the beginning in the early aughts when it was in its earliest form. And she said that she was heckled by gay men there, and they were calling her an ugly lesbian and telling her to leave. So she did not attend Pride for years after that. And I find that to be like a really sad and an indicative story of exactly what you're talking about, gay, cis, male privilege and centering in these types of events. And I think it's gotten better. Now there is definitely a more diverse and inclusive atmosphere at Tokyo Rainbow Pride. But at the end of the day, there is still this this type of like gay, cis, male emphasis that is, I think it's a problem in any LGBT community. Not to like overly generalize, but yeah, we should be putting trans folk first and people who don't have the most privilege in the whole queer culture.
Oh, I don't have anything to add except that I think maybe what Graham's starting to say, or, you know, in regards to the sort of alphabet soup of the words we use to talk about ourselves, it's just going to be hard. And I don't know that there is any, I don't know that there is any anything much more complicated than just that it's complicated, right? Like, I don't think I've felt like there's been a strategy. Like, it's not, you know, the queer community doesn't agree with the LGBT community, or that they're different or intertwined or mutually exclusive, or, you know, but it is complicated for sure. That would be Yeah, it's or complex, maybe not complicated, just complex.
Yeah, language is so fluid, and these terms are frequently changing, and they have different backgrounds and associations in different places. It was interesting to listen to Hiroshi Hasegawa, who's been a part of the queer scene for decades, and he was talking about how when he joined, everyone was saying, calling themselves homo, and now that's discrimination. You don't go around saying like he's a homo. But at the time, the word gay was out of fashion and felt more discriminatory. So now those things have changed, and it's going to change. It's keep changing.
Well, what I found really interesting is that in the film, a number of those subjects actually sort of break down the acronym and talking about LGBT and how T doesn't necessarily fit because it's an identity as opposed to a sexuality. Why was it important for you to break it down at such a fundamental level when we're talking about identity, especially since not everyone in the queer community wants an identity attached to them?
Well, just the importance of breaking it down on its own. I think in 2016, when we were shooting most of the film, there was a survey showing that 50% of Japanese society had no idea what LGBT meant, and 25% of the LGBT community didn't know what it meant either. And I think those numbers are probably smaller in North America, but there are definitely plenty of straight people who don't know what LGBT means. And so we wanted to talk about that. And I think it came up during an interview with a dancer at a trans masculine party called Grammy Tokyo. He was talking about how he does see the separation between trans folk and lesbian, gay, and bisexual folk, but he wants to see the community get along better and move as a whole and not care as much about those distinctions.
You one thing that you or a person you talked about earlier was Nogi Sumiko, and I think I enjoyed her interview the best because she talks about all the ambiguous bits, and sort of what you don't see on the surface, whether it's with sexuality or identity. And I was getting maybe a bit of Ace Demi vibes from her. Why? I guess in any part of our lives, why is there a need for a certain amount of ambiguity?
That's a big question.
Yeah.
Anne?
I think ambiguity, I mean, I'm going to call upon Tagame for this, who, by all appearances, when you look at his work, you think, okay, this is definitely a guy who's really into dudes. Like, it's so much dick, it's so much ass, it's so masculine and it's so hardcore. But I remember talking to his ex-publisher, who was saying that actually a lot of his audience is woman, and I'm just bringing that up because if we now go into the ambiguity begins with just like, do can could I even say in 5 words what I desire? Like, I couldn't, right? Like, I don't think any of us could. Here's a person whose outputs are all have a really clear signature. His work has a very clear signature, but he has one of the most diverse audiences, and I think that's like a real testament to that question: what, how important is the ambiguity? Like, why am I titillated by, that scene when I don't practice it myself, for example? So that's my answer, but that's a really hard one. I don't know.
I also think there's an importance to ambiguity and clarity. And that's kind of the distinction between words like queer and hentai and something like LGBTQIA plus. Those are very specific labels that are all included in that acronym, and they're really important labels for a lot of people. They give themselves meaning and understanding and help them communicate themselves to others. But at the same time, there is a lot you can't just like communicate with a label. So I love Nogi Sumiko's embrace of the ambiguous. And I think that's a running theme throughout the film. Vivian Sato also mentioned that she doesn't like to have herself boiled down to one category. Yes, she is a drag queen, but she's also somebody who displays her drag at most times when she's out and about in the world, when she's going to the bank and the grocery store. That's how she likes to present. So is she transgender? Is that something else? It's definitely performative, but she doesn't really need an identity marker to explain herself. She just says, I am Vivian Sato, and mm-hmm. that's all you need to know. And she also, you know, encourages people to adopt a new identity, try something out. It changes, and it's good to embrace that change.
You know, on this note of the ambiguous, the film does touch on a lot of the historical aspects of queer culture in Japan, whether it's through art, through fashion. A lot of the geishas I know in olden times were men. How was that important in tying the whole story together for you?
I feel like I did a lot of research before making the film about what it was about, Edo period and Meiji period, expressions of queer sexuality. And I find it really fascinating. There's a lot that I never knew about and that hasn't been part of the mainstream conversation of like queer history so much, because unfortunately it has often focused on North American queer history. A lot of depictions of the sort of struggle that LGBT people have been through in the world start in like 1950s America, which is a very limited scope. And I think it was important for us to expand the conversation in this film without making it too much about history. We wanted to set it in the contemporary moment, but of course, history informs that. And we saw that through people like Junko Mitsuhashi. She is a trans activist and lecturer. She's a professor of history. And she talks about the importance of the kimono in historical expressions of trans identity and how she likes to continue that legacy by wearing that when she teaches, when she presents in a photo shoot. And yeah, so we touch on history in the film, but it's so deep that it kind of deserves its own documentary, and probably not one directed by a white man.
I was going to say, I think the most important thing about queering Japanese history is that Japan, like, you know, the US and, you know, Canada to a point, are deeply, you know, heading in a place of fascism, right? Like, really just kind of misplaced ideas of like past greatness, or, you know, just, I don't even need to tell you, but like the ideas of what our cultures and histories are incredibly whitewashed and inaccurate. So the more we can present different and alternative histories, you know, in Japanese culture, I know, like myself growing up with like a Japanese curriculum, if I were 13 and knew about these histories, it would have blown my mind, because I was taught that it was all about like fucking, I don't know, Bushido and like shoguns, you know, like and that's all fake. It's not real. So I think that's important too. Yeah. And like it on top of being fascinating, I think if the end viewer is Japanese, it's important that they know that, you know, history is much more complicated.
And what you just said, Anne, reminds me of when we went to see the Shunga exhibition a few years ago. It was one of the first modern museum exhibitions of erotic artwork in Japan. And it had only come there after first showing at the British Museum, I think, and it had toured sort of the Western world before being accepted in Japanese museums. And it was all of these yukio-e woodblock prints of depicting sexuality in this very like joyful and free and playful way that isn't really like talked about so much in normal or mainstream histories of ukiyo-e in Japan. So like there are all of these histories that are just starting to be re-embraced in contemporary Japanese society.
One thing that we did see at the end of the film was this same-sex ceremony. I believe it was in Okinawa, which I know is one of the districts in Japan that has, I think it's called, what do they call it, a same-sex certificate or something like that. What exactly does that mean legally?
Yeah, so although the Japanese constitution does not allow for same-sex marriage, apparently according to the prime minister, the people in local jurisdictions, in local politics, have started this partnership certificate program, which is somewhat similar to civil unions. It doesn't give the full benefits of marriage, but it does allow the government to note when people have made a union, and it's supposed to be respected by local hospitals, local businesses, and like rent companies and landlords and stuff. So it's a step towards legal recognition of same-sex couples, and it started due to the efforts of politicians like Aya Kamikawa in about 2014 and 15, I think, were the first ones in Tokyo, and now it has spread to more than two dozen cities and prefectures across Japan, including Okinawa.
We heard that last year, I think it was, or maybe a couple of years ago, Taiwan became the first nation in Asia to legalize same-sex marriage. And the Middle East strikes me as still very conservative, but maybe we're starting to see waves of equality in the Far East. Overall, what is your take on same-sex marriage in Asia? How close are we?
It's definitely a complicated situation. I think it's a case-by-case basis on each country, but it was definitely encouraging to see Taiwan become the first to nationally legalize same-sex marriage. And I think that's something that people in Japanese politics, in the opposition, basically the more left people in politics, have been pushing for a long time. There was actually an effort prior to the canceled 2020 Olympics in Tokyo to have same-sex marriage legalized so that it wouldn't become an issue the way that it did for the Olympics in Russia in 2014, when the lack of gay rights in Russia became one of the central narratives of the Olympics there. Unfortunately, that didn't really like persuade people to enact change in Japan, but hey, maybe it'll happen before the 2021 Olympics.
I don't want to poo-poo something that I think a lot of people in the LGBT community value so much, but I wonder, when we have this conversation, I think often about the exact opposite side of the marriage question, which is like in parts of Scandinavia where fewer and fewer straight couples are getting married and having children without legal marriage because the state protects them as parents, co-parents. So why do people want to get married, right? Like what kind of protection does that offer you? So in terms of the legalization of marriage between same-gendered folks in East Asia, like I just keep thinking, why would people need that if they can have protections in other ways to other aspects of their lives together, right? Whereas in the US, it's borderline impossible to raise a child without that legal contract or to share resources. And I don't know, I mean, obviously the marriage contract would protect you in a lot of other ways, but I would love to know more. I have to admit, I just don't know what additional security it provides. Because like in the US, you just kind of need it to raise a kid. But I don't know what the purpose would be if, you know, like Japan is, you know, for better or for worse, there's a lot of editorializing right now around the fact that the population in Japan is decreasing, right? But they're doing a lot. They incentivized having children. So that's an area where that's not, you know, you're not exposed if you have a child. You actually have some fringe benefits. They're problematic, but they're still there. So, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I just wonder.
It's kind of like, I feel that a lot of times same-sex marriage is used as a barometer of progress for countries around the world. And although it is one metric of whether or not LGBT people are being treated equally, there are so many other things to look at. And Masaki, who I'll return to, the activist who was protesting at Pride, they're always a contrarian. I love them. And they back when Shibuya became the first regional jurisdiction to announce the partnership program, I remember Masaki saying, this is pinkwashing. The mayor who is like collecting credibility from this is at the same time evicting homeless people from Shibuya Park. And, you know, homelessness is also an LGBT issue. So I think it's complicated. I hope that we see more marriage equality, but that's not the only need expressed by LGBTQ people in Japan and around the world.
I think it was Masai that said, in terms of LGBT equality, Japan needs a few more rebels to fight.
Oh, Akira the Hustler, he was saying that he wants to see more loud and obnoxious people in Japanese society standing up for the rights.
Does that extend farther than Japan, just in society in general? You know, obviously in the U.S., the people who are the most loud and obnoxious tend to be heard the most and get their way. But do we need that on the other side of the coin? Do we need, you know, more activists who are loud and obnoxious?
I think if I'm interpreting your question, yeah, I think for sure actually, you know what? I'll just take one step back. Personally, I think there's also, this is a whole other podcast too, but like media suppression in Japan is actually a thing. So there's just a lot that's underreported. There's tons of demonstrations, but they are never broadcast. So like, that's a thing, right? So maybe what we need is, yes, some more obnoxious activists, but I never thought I would say that. but also maybe some more obnoxious editors and more obnoxious journalists, right? People willing to share what's happening, or when it does happen, it gets airtime, that like it gets transmitted globally more, because it is happening.
That's true. I feel like the Japanese media is pretty constrictive, and that's coming from America. We have a pretty shoddy media ecosystem ourselves, but there were policies passed in Shinzo Abe's administration making freedom of the press a much dicier proposition.
Yeah, it's not guaranteed.
So that's a really cogent point, and I think that if the Japanese media was covering the amount of activism that happens on the left and just throughout Japan, it would be a whole different conversation.
And Graham, what can you tell me about your latest work, Stretching with Graham Colbeans?
Yeah, so it's just a little vlog that I started on YouTube to express myself while doing a little bit of self-care. So I do these little 5 or 10 minute episodes where I talk about issues that are making me anxious, and I just try to like breathe and stretch it out. I really need to get back to it because it's been a few months since I've made one, and you'd think that quarantine would be a great time for something like that, but the anxiety has just been a little high lately. I haven't been able to channel it into an episode, but I hope people check that out. And I have some other short films up on YouTube. You can watch an earlier documentary I did with Anne and Tagame at the House of Gay Art, which is this amazing archive of exactly what it sounds like, Japanese gay art.
Well, the film is Queer Japan, and it is being released on December 11th, if I'm correct. Graham Kolbeins and Ishii, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank
Thank
you.
you for having
Thanks, Dan.
That was my conversation with Graham Kolbeins and Anne Ishii, the director and producer, respectively, on the great new documentary Queer Japan. It is out December 11th. That does it for me today. Be sure to subscribe to Endeavors on Apple, Spotify, Google, Deezer, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can check me out on Mnet Radio Mission, where I air select interviews. You can follow me on social media at Endeavors Radio, or visit us on the web at endeavorsmedia.com. Thanks for tuning in. I'll see you next time. Bye for now.
I just like to have a lot of sex.